Please open your Bibles to Romans chapter 2. We've got a few more verses left to go in chapter 2 before we move into chapter 3. Starting in verse 28 of chapter 2, we read, "For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God." This definition of Jewishness that Paul gives us here is not a new definition. The Old Testament tells us that Jews have always been called to have circumcised hearts. Deuteronomy 10:16. "Therefore circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer." Jesus told the Jews in John 8 that their kinship with Abraham did not mean that they couldn't also have kinship with the devil. They had said, "Abraham is our father," and Jesus said, "You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do." That's John 8:44. So there was always this sense. Jesus talked about it, Moses talked about it in Deuteronomy. There was always this sense in which there were Jews and there were true Jews. John talks about it in Revelation 2:9. "And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan." And again in Revelation 3:9, "Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie." Again, very strong language there in the book of Revelation, that there were some who said they were Jews but were not true Jews. And Paul here at the end of chapter 2 is telling us what it means to be a true Jew. And it's something not just physical, it's something having to do with the heart. Now there's some disagreement in the commentaries about whether Paul is speaking here only of physical Jews or instead he's speaking of spiritual Jews. Now under the former view, physical Jews, Paul is simply reminding us here of something that of what Moses said back in Deuteronomy. That physical Jews have always been called upon to possess these inward qualities, not merely physical qualities. And that view would seem to fit well with the context of the Old Testament passages that Paul is referring to. But under this other view, this latter view, Paul could be speaking of the church. He could be telling us that a real Jew is one who obeys God and who has a circumcised heart. And that group may very well include Gentiles at this time. That is, under the second view, Paul could be speaking of the church and saying that Christians are the true spiritual Jews. And that would fit perhaps well with the context of verse 26 here. Also in the New Testament, as we know, sometimes the church is described as the New Jerusalem or the New Israel, the new dwelling place for God's people. So I don't think we can be real dogmatic on which of those two views here Paul is referring to. We will have a little more to say about that issue when we get to chapters 9 through 11, because those three chapters, which we'll deal with later, is where Paul really deals with the Jewish issue. And he goes into great detail on this and other issues in those chapters. Here's what Barclay says about Paul's definition. "Jewishness," Paul insists, "is not a matter of race at all. It is a matter of conduct. Many a so-called Jew who is a pure descendant of Abraham and who bears the mark of circumcision in his body is no Jew at all. And equally, many a Gentile who never heard of Abraham, who would never dream of being circumcised, is a Jew in the real sense of the term. To a Jew, this would sound the wildest heresy and leave him angry and aghast." So you can tell Barclay takes the latter view, that in fact Paul's definition of Jewishness here is taking in many Gentiles who would never dream of calling themselves a Jew, and certainly a Jew would never dream of calling them a Jew. Moser says in his commentary that thus the apostle swept from under the Jew the very foundation upon which he relied for divine approval. And that's really what has happened here at the end of this chapter. They've had their legs chopped out from them. Those who relied on the law, those who relied on the covenant of circumcision, Paul has swept that out from under them. The phrase at the end of this chapter, very interesting, "whose praise is not from men, but from God." This phrase contains a pun that is completely untranslatable. The Greek word for praise is epenos, and that's the word that appears here. if you go back to the Old Testament, Genesis 29:35, for example, or Genesis 49:8, you'll find that the original and traditional meaning of the word Judah is praise. Praise. The word Judah meant praise. Thus, this phrase here, whose praise is not from men but from God, really is telling us two things. Their praise comes from men and not from God, and the Jewishness of such a man should come from God and not from man. But theirs was coming from man and not from God. The praise and the Jewishness are tied in together in that word. Whose praise is not from men but from God. Whose Jewishness is not from men but from God. God has bestowed that. Whose praise is not from men but from God. The people that Paul had just been describing, their praise had been coming from man. From man. That's who they had been trying to receive praise from. And Jesus talked all about that throughout the Gospels. Luke 6:26. Woe to you when all men speak well of you. All men speak well of you. Woe? We wouldn't think that would be a bad thing. Jesus said it was. Why? For that so did their fathers to the false prophets. And Luke 16:15. You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God. Highly esteemed and praised by man, abomination in the sight of God. And John 12:43. For they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. That's the group that Paul is addressing here. And he's telling them their praise should come from God. And he's telling them their Jewishness should come from God. The true Jew seeks the praise of God rather than the praise of men. Let's move in then to chapter 3. We're going to deal with the first 20 verses of chapter 3, and then the next series of lessons will pick up in verse 21, where a major break in the argument occurs. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 20, has one main point, but it's interrupted by a brief diversion from that main point. And I think when we see the diversion and see the flow of the main point, the chapter is much easier to understand. The main point is for Paul to present a biblical indictment of the Jews. A biblical indictment of the Jews, which is the logical conclusion to this whole section of Paul's letter. He's talked about the Gentiles, indicted the Gentiles, he's talked about the Jews. It's now time for a biblical indictment of the Jews from their own law. That main point starts in verses 1 and 2, and then it ends in verses 9 through 20. 1 and 2, 9 through 20. The diversion that we're going to talk about from that main argument is in verses 3 through 8. And in the handout, you can see I've kind of moved that over to the right side of the page a bit for you to see that that's the diversion where he deals with some objections that have been raised. He deals with these objections just by mentioning them here. He comes back to them in chapters 9 through 11, and we get a full discourse on these objections in chapters 9 through 11, which we will study later in the series. But briefly, here are some of the objections that are raised to Paul's message that he mentions here. If the Jews were really given this advantage that he's going to talk about in chapter 3, then why have most of them failed to receive the promised blessings? That's one objection. Second, if the death of Christ was the will of God, as Paul is going to tell us, then how can the Jews be blamed for carrying out the will of God? That's the second objection. The third objection, if the death of Christ was the channel through which blessings came to the whole world, then why is it that so many Jews have not been blessed, even though the cross has been accomplished? That's another objection that is raised. And we will deal with those. Verse 1. What advantage, then, has the Jew? Or what is the profit of circumcision? Much in every way, chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God. Paul has just finished telling the Jews that they are in the same boat as the Gentiles. And in fact, he's told them that boat is sinking. They are in the same boat despite the Jews having the Mosaic Law and despite the Jews having this mark and covenant of circumcision. They're in the same boat. He just got finished telling them that. They are in the same boat, but with regard to salvation, they're in the same boat. They're both lost without Jesus Christ, both groups. And they're both saved through faith in Jesus Christ. through obedient faith in Jesus Christ. That's how they're saved. They're lost without Him. They're saved the same way through Jesus Christ. That's what He had just told them. Now, before we launch into what He's telling them in chapter 3, we need to keep that in mind, that that is what Paul has just told the Jews and the Gentiles alike. Why is that an important point? Because many commentators get to this chapter and later chapters, and they try to unwind what Paul has just told them. They try to unwind it. They're going to argue, many of these commentators are going to argue, that Jews and Gentiles are not in the same boat with respect to salvation. That God has some special plan for the Jews with regard to their salvation that's going to happen perhaps in the end times. And He's got a different plan for the Jews. They're in a different boat. That's what these commentators say. And yet Paul has told us just the opposite. He's taken great pains to tell us with regard to salvation, there's no distinction here. The Jews and the Gentiles are lost without Jesus Christ, and they're saved the same way through faith in Jesus Christ. So let's keep that in mind as we plow ahead. But is there not any advantage at all to being a Jew? That is the question Paul addresses here. And he gives what might seem like a surprising answer at this point. He's just told us they're in the same boat. He's just told us that they're both lost and condemned in sin apart from Jesus Christ. And the question comes up, well, is there any advantage then to being a Jew? You might expect him to say, no. I just told you, you're in the same boat. There's no special... He says, yes, much, in every way, there is some advantage to being a Jew. What are those advantages? He says, much, in every way. There are many advantages. He gives a single example here. They were entrusted with the oracles of God. In chapter 9, verses 4 and 5, he's going to list a lot of other advantages. They are Israelites to whom pertain the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the service of God, and the promises, of whom are the fathers, and from whom, according to the flesh, Christ came, who is over all the eternally blessed God. Many, many advantages. He lists one here, he lists many others when he treats this question in more detail in chapter 9. Entrusted with the oracles of God. The word entrusted, or committed, used here, the Greek word suggests both a privilege and a responsibility. As one commentator noted, the Jews were the custodians of the divine revelation. But that carried not just a privilege, but a responsibility. Amos 3:2, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. And how does that verse end? Therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. God had put them in a special position, but that carried a great responsibility. To whom much is given, much is required. Remember what Jesus told the woman at the well in John 4:22? Salvation is of the Jews. Salvation is of the Jews. That was a wonderful privilege for the Jews, but it was also a great, great responsibility that salvation came of the Jews. Acts 7:52 through 53. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? They killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. A great, great privilege. Received the law by the direction of angels and yet have not kept it. A great privilege and a great responsibility. But it was an advantage, wasn't it? It was an advantage, and it's the first one Paul lists here. The oracles of God, certainly they speak of the entirety of the Old Testament Scriptures, but I think the context here tells us that Paul was specifically referring to the messianic prophecies in the Old Testament Scriptures, which, as we know, permeate the Old Testament Scriptures. Why is it that he was most likely specifically focusing on the oracles, the prophecies of the Messiah? Well, first, Paul is only giving one example here of the many advantages of the Jews. And what greater advantage was there than the promised Messiah and the oracles concerning the promised Messiah? This advantage is introduced here with the word chiefly. Chiefly. Paul is giving the most important advantage. And that most important advantage was not the old law that could not save them, that was powerless to save them. The most important advantage was the Messiah who could save them. So I think the oracles Paul had in mind here are specifically the messianic prophecies. There's a second reason. In the following verses, Paul is going to discuss the Jewish failure to obtain the promised messianic blessings and promises. So it would make sense that the chief advantage that he gave would be the oracles about this coming promised Messiah, that the bulk of the Jews had failed to obtain blessings from. Now it's at this point, after verse 2, that Paul starts to deal with these objections that could be raised to his message. And this diversion goes all the way down to verse 8. But if you skip now, if you now just kind of skip down to verse 9, you will get his unbroken thought from verse 1 and 2 down to verse 9. Verses 1 and 2, he's just told us the Jews have advantages. If you now skip down to verse 9, the question is, but then are the Jews better than the Gentiles with these advantages? And he says, not at all. Not at all. All are under the same curse of sin. Verse 9, he's going to get back to his theme. We're all in the same boat. We're all under the same curse of sin. Yes, the Jews have advantages, but no, that does not mean they are better in some saving sense than the Gentiles. We're all under the same curse of sin. Why do we have this break between verses 3 through 8? We discover in Romans 16:22 that Paul dictated this epistle. He dictated this epistle. You can imagine him pacing back and forth as he's making his arguments and giving us the wonderful book of Romans through inspiration. And you can see him perhaps stopping every moment to give a brief sermon on another topic. And I think that's what happened here. This occurred to him. He put this in, verses 3 through 8, knowing he's going to come back to it, which he does in 9 through 11. But he stops here and gives us this, and you can just see him doing this. If we could travel back through history to see historical events, there'd be many things we'd want to see on our list. But I think somewhere on my list would be Paul dictating the book of Romans. Paul dictating the book of Romans. Verse 3. This starts the diversion from the main argument. For what if some did not believe? Will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? Certainly not. Indeed, let God be true, but every man a liar. As it is written, that you may be justified in your words and may overcome when you are judged. Paul begins here to consider an objection to his message, and particularly an objection to the God of Paul's gospel. Wasn't Paul here proclaiming a God who promised the Jews blessings, yet failed to deliver those blessings? Not at all, Paul says. In fact, as the King James Version says, God forbid. God forbid. One commentator writes, the very suggestion that God might become unfaithful causes the apostle to shudder. God forbid, the very thought. Well, then what's going on? Because most of the Jews had failed to receive these promised blessings. He gives us a hint right here. He says, for what if some did not believe? Paul is implying something here that elsewhere he states very explicitly. Faithfulness was bound upon the Jew to receive these blessings. It was a condition for receiving these blessings. Faithfulness to God. These blessings were not unconditional. There was no Jew alive who could come to God and demand His promised blessings. It was faithfulness to God was the condition to receive blessings through Jesus Christ, the coming Messiah. And that is something Paul alludes to here. He said, for what if some did not believe? He's telling us that these people who did not get the blessings had not believed in the coming Messiah, in Jesus Christ. But then is faithfulness, Paul, some kind of a hook? Is this some kind of a loophole that God uses to keep people from getting the promised blessings? Hardly. God did not condition the blessings on faithfulness to keep people from getting them. God conditioned the blessings on faithfulness to enable people to get them. It's hardly a hook or a loophole. It's the way in which man can receive the blessings from God. That's why God conditioned them on faithfulness. There was another way they could have gotten the blessings, right? That would have been to keep the law perfectly. And of course, he knew they could not do that. So he came up with a way in which they could receive the blessings, and that was faithfulness to him and to his son, Jesus Christ. So the Jews were promised blessings, yet most of them failed to receive those blessings. Is that God's fault? Well, it would be if God had intentionally tried to prevent the Jews from receiving the blessings. That is, if God had been faithless. But of course, God was doing just the opposite. He was working to bring blessings to all the Jews, in fact, to all of mankind. It was His will that all would receive the blessings. it was not God who was faithless. It was the Jews. They were the ones who were faithless. They were faithless to God, and that is why they did not receive the blessings. Notice that these verses tell us God had blessed some of the Jews. Verse 3 says that some did not believe. Not all did not believe. If some did not believe, that means some did believe, and those who did believe, in fact, had been blessed through their obedience to the gospel and their faith in Jesus Christ. That some received the blessings proves that God was not being faithless at all. He had made it possible, Paul is saying, for all the Jews to receive the blessings. It was just up to them. They had to come to Him in faith. And He had made it possible for all of the Jews to receive the blessings. And Paul suggests that by saying that some had. Some had certainly not been blessed, but some had been blessed. In fact, Paul was an example of someone who had received these blessings. But what, Paul, what if all of the Jews had failed to receive the blessings? What if all of the Jews had been faithless? What if none of the Jews had received the promised blessings? Then I guess that would mean God was faithless. Not at all. Even that would not prove that God was faithless. Let God be true, but every man a liar, Paul says. Let God be true, but every man a liar. And then after that, he quotes a section from Psalm 51, verse 4, that Paul quotes after saying that. This is the Psalm 51, verse 4. Against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. You'll recognize that as David's confession of the horrible sin with Bathsheba. David had just confessed a horrible sin, and he made this why did he make that confession? He tells us here in Psalm 51. He made that confession so that all would know that God was just and blameless, that while ever God punished him, it would be just and it would be fair. That's why David made that confession, so the world would know that his coming punishment was just and God was blameless in giving that punishment to him. Whatever decision God made, it would be a righteous decision. That's why David made that confession in Psalm 51. He tells us why. And Paul here quotes that, right after telling us, let God be true, but every man a liar. Why? Man's sin does not change the nature of God. God is just and God is blameless no matter what we do. We have only ourselves to blame if we fail to receive the wonderful blessings that He has made available to the entire world. Can we change the nature of God by a popular vote? Can we change the gospel by a popular vote? Paul's answer, let God be true, but every man a liar. If there's one verse in the Bible that demolishes relativism, this is it. The truth is absolute and objective, and it comes from God. It's not relative. It's not subjective. We don't determine the truth. The news today has been reduced to nothing but opinion polls. They give an issue, and then they give the opinion poll. Abortion. What are we going to think about abortion? Well, we've done an opinion poll, and here's what the people say. Okay, that means abortion's all right. Cloning. Well, this is a sticky issue. We did an opinion poll. Came out slightly in favor of cloning, so I guess cloning's okay. If every single person in the United States voted that abortion is all right, would that make abortion all right? No. Every single person in the United States voted in favor of cloning, would that make cloning all right? No. If every person who ever lived on the face of this planet raised his hand to vote against God and the truth of His Word, it would make absolutely no difference. No difference. The world does not determine the truth. Let God be true, but every man a liar. The church does not determine the truth. The elders do not determine the truth. God's word is truth, and man cannot change that truth. But, you say, my church has voted to permit women to take leadership roles in worship. My church has voted to permit homosexuals to have roles in clerical roles. My church has voted to have worship services on Saturday. In my church, the elders got together and decided that divorce and remarriage is all right for just any reason. In my church, the elders got together and decided that instrumental music is okay. My church decided to join forces with denominations. My church got together and voted, and we decided now that baptism is not really essential to salvation. Paul's answer to all that, let God be true, but every man a liar. There are many wonderful descriptions of the church in Scripture. But democracy is not one of them. The church is a kingdom, and we are under a king, and we are all servants of that king. The church is a monarchy. Verse 5. But if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unjust to inflict wrath? I speak as a man. Certainly not. For then how would God judge the world? The next question Paul addresses. If man's unrighteousness gives God's righteousness a chance to shine, to be manifested, then isn't man's unrighteousness a good thing? And if it's a good thing, how can God punish us for it? We mentioned earlier that what we're reading here is possibly a sermon that Paul preached a number of times in the synagogues. You can see him preaching this, as we discussed, because he kind of lays the trap for the Jews, getting them to agree with them how horrible the Gentiles are, and then springing the trap. You can just see him in the synagogue making this argument. And if that's so, what we're probably seeing here are actual objections raised by his audience in those synagogues. You can just see the audience coming up to Paul and saying, yeah, Paul, we're hearing you, but you know, what you're saying doesn't really make sense here. Let me tell you why. You can see the objections coming back to him. I think what he's doing here is addressing objections that he actually got when he presented this to the Jewish synagogues. I think this particularly makes sense because I don't think Paul would have thought of this silly objection otherwise, unless it had been raised by one of his listeners. And in fact, I think this view is supported by what he says here. He says, I'm speaking after the manner of men. That's what he says right here in verse 5. I don't think he's given his own views or his own objections. I think he's saying that these are the views of these people that heard my message and objected to the message. I'm speaking after the manner of men. These are the kind of objections they would come up with. Paul is telling the Jews that Jesus had to die in order for the world to receive the blessings, the promised blessings. It was therefore God's will that Jesus would be a sacrifice for sin. The Jews, therefore, they're saying, we did the will of God in delivering up His Son to be the sacrifice for sin. So how can God punish us for doing the will of God? Is that fair? And Paul, the question Paul asks, is God unjust who inflicts wrath? Is that fair? Paul's answer is that God can turn any man's sin into His glory. Paul's going to develop this theme a lot more in chapters 9 through 11. But if the Jewish objector can use God's ability to turn man's sin into His own glory, if he can use that as a shield from God's wrath, then anybody can use that as a shield from God's wrath. And God can turn any man's sin ultimately into His own glory. And so how could God judge the world if this objection holds? Each time someone came up to be judged, they would simply argue, well, if it hadn't been for my sin, Jesus wouldn't have come into the world, and He wouldn't have had to have died, and you wouldn't have received the glory, and so you wouldn't be able to bless the world as you promised, so I guess I'm off the hook, God. Everyone would be able to say that. Paul is saying, if your objection's true, how is God going to judge the world? How is God going to judge the world? And of course, as I've mentioned, he's going to come back to this in 9 through 11. Of course, the whole objection is ridiculous. That God can use our sin to bring about something good does not in any way absolve us from that sin. Verse 7. For if the truth of God has increased through my lie to His glory, why am I also still judged as a sinner? And why not say, let us do evil that good may come? As we are slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, their condemnation is just. The next objection by Paul's listener is similar to the previous one, but it goes in a little different direction. All right, Paul, let's assume that God can use sin to bring glory to Himself and that He can simultaneously condemn the sinner for that sin. But doesn't that mean, Paul, that we should just go ahead and keep on sinning? Aren't we doing God a favor when we sin? Paul's going to pick this one up in Romans 6, verse 1. But here he deals with it briefly. If the truth and faithfulness of God can be seen in the death of Christ, then surely that act should be praised, right? And the people who perpetrated it should be honored instead of rejected, right? That's the Jewish objection here. Well, Paul properly dismisses this argument as ridiculous as well. In fact, he labels as slanderous those who have put those words into his mouth. He says their condemnation is just. I kind of see in between the lines, their condemnation at least is just. In other words, maybe you're right that no one else needs to be condemned, but this group certainly is just in being condemned. The argument here that they were making is that the logical outcome of Paul's message is that we should just keep on sinning. And as I've mentioned, in chapter 6, he's going to deal with that. He's going to show us that that's not the logical outcome of his message at all. And one lesson for us here is don't get into a logic argument with the Apostle Paul. He'll make mincemeat out of you. Some commentators argue that Paul is turning here the Jewish objection back on the objectors. They said they should not be held sinful if their sin brought glory to God. And Paul then asks here, well, if men call him personally a sinner, and if his personal, Paul's lie, has increased the truth of God, then how are they saying that Paul is condemned? That lie in the mind of the Jewish objectors was the gospel of Christ. The Jews regarded that as a lie. One commentator has it as if Paul is saying, you arraign me before the bar of Jewish opinion, even as you yourselves are arraigned before the bar of God. Yet you would not permit me to use the very same argument that you are seeking to use before God. There's some support for this view in the change of the pronouns. Verse 5, our unrighteousness. Verse 7, my lie. Changes to first person here. It's a possibility. Now, with the next verse, we pick up with the main argument that started in verses 1 and 2. We're through for the moment with these objections. We're going to come back to them in chapters 9 through 11. Verse 9 picks up with the main argument that started in verses 1 and 2. One commentator writes, these verses are something of a bridge between earlier and later parts of the letter, or they're like a railway junction through which many of the key ideas and themes of the epistle pass. Verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. In chapter 2, Paul showed that the Jews and Gentiles were in the same boat with regard to condemnation and salvation. He just said in verses 1 and 2 that there are some advantages to being a Jew. The question now in verse 9, are we then better than they? If the Jews were certain of anything, it was that they were better than the Gentiles. And yet Paul's answer is not at all. Not at all. Paul's argument here was calculated to astonish the Jews, and I'm sure it did. In chapters 3, verses 1 and 2, Paul had agreed the Jews had certain advantages. But now in verse 9, he makes it clear those advantages don't make the Jews better than the Gentiles. The Greek word for better here can mean protected or sheltered. And I think that fits very well with the context here. Do these advantages mean the Jews are sheltered? Do these advantages mean the Jews are protected from the wrath of God? The answer is no. The answer is not at all. Why? He tells us right here, because Jew and Gentile are under sin, the advantages of the Jews are not saving advantages. They may have had a head start in the race, but they still must finish the race. They must finish the course. In fact, if they fail to finish the race, after having had a head start, it's possible they're going to end up in a worse position than if they had not had that head start. To whom much is given, much is required. These advantages were privileges and they were responsibilities, but they did not protect the Jews from the wrath of God. Only Jesus Christ could provide that blessing and the saving advantages that were made available to both Jew and Gentile. Verse 10, as it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one. What begins in verse 10 and continues through verse 19 is an indictment of the Jews right out of their own law. Paul linked the Jews and the Gentiles together in verse 9. And so it might appear that this indictment in verses 10 through 19 is directed to both Jew and Gentile. Verse 19, though, I think will make it clear that this indictment is directed only to the Jews, those under the law from which these verses were taken. Paul has already shown that the Gentiles are under sin. He's already indicted them. His goal here is to make a similar indictment against the Jews. And what better place to go for that than their own law, to go right from their own law. Verses 10 through 12 are from Psalm 14, 1 through 3. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good. No, not one. It's from Psalm 14. What was David saying? Was he saying there that no one at all in the entire nation was righteous? No. In fact, if you look at verse 5 of Psalm 14, David wrote that God was the protector of the generation of the righteous. David was talking about two groups of people here, the unrighteous and the righteous. So what was David saying there? He was saying that sin was so rampant among the people that it was hardly an exaggeration on his part to say they're all wicked. They've all turned aside. The atheist there in Psalm 14:1, that's the pragmatic atheist. That's the one that David talked about in chapter 10, verse 4. The wicked in his proud countenance does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. If you stopped him on the street and asked him, do you believe in God? I guess he'd probably say, well, I guess I do. But God was in none of his thoughts. He was a pragmatic atheist. That's what David is talking about here. These were Jews who had turned aside. And he's saying they've all done this. It's an exaggeration, but hardly an exaggeration. David is saying it's gotten so bad that they've all, in a sense, turned aside. The word for unprofitable in verse 12 is a Greek word that can refer to milk that has gone sour. They had together become unprofitable. They're just like milk that has gone sour. Paul thus begins this indictment by showing that the Jews had a history of wickedness rather than a history of righteousness. David, who they all revered, had been able to write that none were righteous, that all had turned aside. Continuing in verse 13, their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. The way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. He continues in verses 13 through 18 with more specific indictments. In fact, he's saying the Jews are utterly contaminated with sin. He mentions their throats, their tongues, their lips, their mouth, their feet, their eyes. They are utterly contaminated with sin. Paul's point is to show that the Jewish nation stands guilty before God. It has been completely penetrated and permeated with sin. His point here is not to show that there are no faithful people anywhere among the Jews. Indeed, Paul was a Jew, and he was faithful to God. And he was writing to a church in Rome that no doubt had faithful Jewish Christians. Indeed, that was not David's point either. The passages cited here speak of two groups of people, those filled with sin and those who were faithful to God. Why is this distinction important? Because Calvinists used these passages, to support their doctrine of total depravity. That all men are faithless rebels to God. Well, that wasn't David's point, and that's not Paul's point either. In fact, if you flip over to Romans 5:12, you will see the doctrine of total depravity completely demolished. Therefore, just as through one man, that's Adam, sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men. Why did death spread to all men? Because Adam sinned? Because all men sinned. If Paul had agreed with John Calvin in total depravity, this was the point for him to tell us. Death spread to all men because Adam sinned. But he didn't say that. He said death spread to all men because all men sinned. That sermon was free of charge. The other verses cited here by Paul.
One of those 3 through 8 diversions.
Yeah, that's another diversion. The other verses cited here are from Psalms and Isaiah, and I won't take the time to read those. They're on the handout there, and you can see that where Paul was quoting those. And I will mention that those verses also have these two groups. Paul is pulling out the description of the unrighteous, but it was not the point of David and these other passages to say that everybody had become faithless rebels. There was the righteous remnant also. They may have been few in number, but it existed. The way of peace they had not known. The way of peace they have not known. In just a few short years from when this book was written, the Jewish system was going to come to a very swift end with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And if you want to read about peace, you might look at Luke 19:41-44. As Jesus looks out over the city and says, if you had known, even you, especially in this your day, the things that make for your peace, but they did not. They did not. And Paul says it here also. They did not know the things that made for peace. Verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Paul's claim here is that no reasonable Jew could argue with the passage that these passages were not directed to him. This law speaks to those under the law, and the Jews were under the law. Paul is telling them, these passages are speaking to you. This is an indictment of the Jews. It's right there in their own law for all to see. He had already stopped the mouths of the Gentiles. Now he has stopped the mouths of the Jews. Every mouth is now stopped. There's nothing left to argue. There's nothing left to say. He had previously indicted the Gentiles. He now indicted the Jews. All the world stands guilty before God. Verse 20. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. There is no definite article before the word law in verse 20. Paul has told us that both Jew and Gentile are under law, and that neither will be justified by law. For by the law is knowledge of sin. A law against a certain action makes you aware that that action is forbidden. In that sense, we become knowledgeable of what is sin. But the word for knowledge here is not gnosis, which means knowledge. It's epignosis. The prefix epi magnifies the knowledge. It's a deeper knowledge. It's a more intimate knowledge that Paul is describing here. Paul is telling us more than simply the law makes us aware of what is sinful. He's speaking of something deeper than that. Man obtains a deeper understanding than simply knowing what is right and what is wrong. Well, what is that deeper understanding? Law tells man what sin is. But when man breaks the law and sins, he understands what sin means. And that's this deeper knowledge. He knows that he now stands condemned. He understands the consequences of that sin. When you tell a child not to use bad language, that child has knowledge, gnosis, of what is wrong. When that child gets his mouth washed out with soap, he has epignosis. At the end of verse 20, all of mankind stands condemned before God. At the end of verse 20. All men are under the law. All men have violated that law. No man can be justified by that law. The Jews and the Gentiles are in the same boat, and that boat is sinking. That's the condition in verse 20. And the first word of verse 21 is the most beautiful word we could have imagined at this point. But. And that's where the second part of the story begins, with verse 21. But something is about to change this horrible state that Paul has described. Without Jesus Christ, the book of Romans would have ended at verse 20. And we should thank God every day for the word but in verse 21. Thank you for your attention.